they may have a whole bunch of new or enhanced capabilities that somebody forgot to tell the users, hey, you can now do this with that.
Hi, this is Greg Young.
And this is Bill Malik. And you're listening to Real Cybersecurity. So how are you doing today, Greg?
Oh, that's always a complicated question. I like to pass.
Could I buy a vowel?
Yes. I tut again in these uncertain times. Yes. Are there even vowels anymore? Or is it all consonants, it seems, in cybersecurity?
It seems like what's happened to cybersecurity is the same thing that happened to Europe. The Western nations got all the vowels and the Eastern nations got all the consonants.
I wish we had more umlauts.
Oh, yes. They're sort of stuck in the middle, aren't they?
Yeah. And being only slightly bilingual in French, I'm terrible with, I think I have a good French accent, but the accents in French, the accent aigu, accent grave, I always get those wrong. So, And for our non-Francophone listeners, that's the little bent line above the vowels.
The slanty E's and E's.
Yes.
Slanty thing, yes.
And the left and the right one.
Well, I think if you say it with style and conviction, then your pronunciation is correct.
Exactly right. It's not the, and all that alternate keyboard stuff is very confusing as well. So a couple of things we agreed to talk about today. So the less controversial one and more informative in some ways may be talking about the channel.
How do you get your information security products and tools? How do you find somebody? How do you build and sustain a relationship with them? And what do the vendors do to strengthen their channel? Interesting question.
This came up this week because we were looking at a report that's coming out on success in channel and cybersecurity. And for a lot of cybersecurity pros who aren't in the business of buying or selling, and that is disproportionately large, as it should be hopefully out there, you've been protected from that. As you said, Bill, it's how products get to you. How do you buy stuff? How do you acquire it?
Yeah, I've been interested in this for quite a while. I was at my dentist's office many years ago, and I noticed he had a Windows box driving the screen to my right as I was sitting in the chair, and I didn't play with it, didn't look through any of it. But it occurred to me, you know, how does he get software? How does he get updates? How does he get trained? So I asked him. In his particular case, he'd had a relationship with a channel that served medical professional small offices in the corner of Connecticut that I'm in. They didn't really do much follow-up, didn't do much time on that. I spent a little time discussing what I did with him and what kinds of things I would look at, and I ended up being given permission to spend time with him in the office after hours and just go about cleaning up the machines. And we found some of the boxes had 20 or 30,000 cookies on them. Some of the browser histories had never been erased. Some of the recycle bins had never been emptied and stuff had never been compacted. So after about 4 or 5 hours, the machines were running. His subjective experience was twice as fast as they had been. And I didn't install anything and I didn't remove anything. I just did normal basic maintenance. And so does your channel support you? Do they help you keep things in shape? I guess the relationship would be like, you know, the company that you lease your car from. They are not GM or Mercedes, but they are the piece of GM or Mercedes that you as the person leasing the car deal with.
Right, right. Yes. Yeah. I doubt if your dentist or doctor has time to meet with over 2,000 security vendors, according to our good friend Richard Steen, and that's how many security vendors are. We see over 2,300 or 2,100.
Yeah.
Just by that metric alone, nobody has time to do that, nor do those 2,100 companies all want a giant sales force that will all go try to bother your doctor or dentist. The numbers don't make sense. So it turns out that, especially at the midsize, small midsize businesses, the partners they deal with, to bring them their IT stuff, sell a lot of stuff, not just security. They will sell their, like, an extension of their, effectively can be their IT department. They can be their first line of support. Most people will be surprised to learn that most of the big security companies have no direct sales, with only some exceptions. They sell stuff, but the channel is how it's delivered. Those are partners, resellers, distributors. There's ISVs, value-added resellers, system integrators. There's all kinds of flavor within it, but it really, you know, the one I always think of most naturally is going to be just a reseller, somebody who's going to, you know, represent your product, train their people in it, and go out and sell it for you.
Yeah, so that's a step above going to your generic store, your Best Buy or Staples, and buying the box. I mean, they're happy to sell you the box, but they're not going to help you install it or give you tech support to troubleshoot it.
Right, right. Yeah, retail is part of the channel, definitely. Online sales. Your car dealership is an interesting one because it brings up the example of Tesla, who had their own dealerships, but it's all like online for them. And that brings up the cloud example, how that's really been disruptive in some ways to the channel, but in other ways not.
Well, at some point, a person who represents the seller's organization is going to have to physically come down out of the cloud and visit the individual who's running the stuff, right?
Are you going to? In some cases, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I suppose you could get everything off the cloud, but there's still going to have to be a bootstrap. There's going to be a moment where you've taken the PC out of the box and you've wired it up right, you hope. But if you can't get to what you need, you're going to have to call somebody for help, and there may actually be a physical on-site visit at that point.
Right. Software as a service is that unusual aspect now where there is no delivery. It's all software. There may not even be a channel involved. Hopefully there will be, but yeah, it's really this ability of software as a service and a lot of the cloud apps and that. It's really different now. It really changed this model of we're used to have a lot of channel be physically present. I think that though, that what the value they bring is, again, knowing the customer. That all came to me during one meeting. I was at a security vendor, and they had one of the resellers there. He represented a lot of small companies who were his clients, but he was effectively their extended part of their IT department, not just for security, but security was a big part of what he did. And he was in there giving the vendor heck. He was telling them what they should be changing, why it was cumbersome. Yeah, the customer might have had some views on that, but he would deal with 50 customers who all had to deal with these issues. So he was a great resource for that. So he was telling them what this kind of the dentist's office and the lawyer's office is, what they needed and what was good and bad about this. I thought it was just, wow. I said, what a clear example of the value of the channel. He knows the customer. He knows the product. He's the glue in between. He's going to deliver it, support it. He really cares because he's got his whole businesses on the stake with these products. So yeah, it all kind of crystallized there for me.
That's right. It falls down. If the technology doesn't work or it's not serviceable, the customer is going to turn away, and the person is going to take the hit as the channel, not the vendor. They'll find somebody else. I remember, I was working with a startup quite some time ago, and they had a really nasty habit of undercutting their channel. Their channel would find a lead, get the thing in there, and then the vendor would step in with a lower price and throw the
word
channel
gets out.
Word
gets out pretty quick.
They had a very rapid end. And then you have the other side, which is where the business itself may have its own sales force. And then you have to avoid channel conflicts. And so you get whole
exactly right. Yep.
Which channel actually owns the deal? And then you get in the whole, what's the deal registration process and how do you ensure equity? Now you throw cloud on top of that, and then you have to say, well, how do you compensate the salespeople for guiding a customer to purchase on the cloud?
When in doubt, double comp.
Compensate
both. Nothing good comes from channel conflict.
Right.
The greatest product evaluations I ever saw done were not by the biggest companies out there, although there's a few exceptions, of course, but mostly they were by distributors. These are the largest sort of players in this field, and there's some very well-known names there. But for them, when they decide to represent and get involved with a product, it's a big investment. So for them, it's not only what are we going to make on this, it's is this a good product or not?
Yeah.
Because you can't push junk out in the channel. If you have a bad product, nobody's going to want to rep it. But then you have to treat the channel well and treat them fairly and help them with leads and things like that as well. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's not going to be any success there. So got to have number one is good product. Number two is to deal with your channel effectively. And that typically means being a good partner.
Yep. Rule of thumb, always be nice to people who bring you money.
You know what, though? In the IT world, that is not always practiced. That's a foundational rule, the golden rule. But funny, we've all seen people fall down on that. In fact, the channel, anybody listening out there is part of the channel, a reseller or a VAR or system integrator, you will have seen the ugliness there. Or product making business, you've probably seen the bad behaviors out there, which nothing good comes from that.
Yeah. Getting headspace in a major channel partner is a struggle. It requires an investment, time and money, and the company, the vendor, has to then step up with training and level 2 or level 3 support behind that. You don't want to leave channel thing. They don't know what to do because the customer will pick up that in about a nanosecond.
Yeah. And just specific tools for them as well, just to be able to do their job better and see the client starts are helping them with renewals and helping them see what the statuses of licenses are, not just on a one-off basis, having having them track it themselves, or have the customers go to them and say, hey, I think this is near renewal, or what version am I running? I'm not sure. You just have to make it easy for them. So
I'm drafting a piece that looks at that particular aspect you just mentioned. What is the current release level? And one of the things I'm suggesting to folks is that it may be a good time to take a look at your portfolio, particularly of SaaS technologies, because the vendors who are behind there are working away to enhance product functionality. And some of those products that were acquired 3, 4, 5 years ago, they may have a whole bunch of newer enhanced capabilities that somebody forgot to tell the users, hey, you can now do this with that. So I'm suggesting you want to have some kind of a huddle with your principal channel partners and distributors and say, look, we've been using this since 2009, and we'd like to know, what are we missing? What have they done in the last 11 years that we might not even know about?
Right. Yeah, of course, there's security implications there too. It's a great example. Not only is there license management and spending, but you know, the vulnerability state and the like. So those are closely tied. So
now, to what extent does a company turn over responsibility for its software asset management to the channel? I mean, thinking of, you know, the smaller place, you're not going to have 16 channel partners and 3 SIs if you're running a 20-person doctor's office.
Yeah, it's mostly dependent on vertical. Again, I am not an expert in the channel. There's probably somebody listening who knows much more about this. They're going to be guffawing. So number one is vertical. If you're in that sort of manufacturing, that type C enterprise, as they're often called, manufacturing, mining, those things, it's going to be, hey, channel, you are an extension of my IT department. In fact, you may even be my IT department, no matter how big my company is. Very, very large companies, but don't rely heavily on technology. Those will be them. On the other hand, some very, very tiny companies. I've seen some investment companies who are tiny, and they wouldn't let anybody near them. They would be very specific. They would go right and they would pick their channel partner for a specific product and just almost use them for fulfillment only and say, hey, we know what we want. Here's what we want. Here's the version. Here's the price we want. Bring it now. And they would be like a 20-person shop, but they were so embedded in technology, they would know that. So yeah, it really depends on the vertical more than the size. Although as a generalization, SMBs do tend to have a closer relationship with channel partners and fewer of them. And the bigger companies, the big, you know, Fortune 500, typically will say partner per product.
Yeah, I remember years ago when I did briefings working at IBM, we'd have aerospace firms, high-tech manufacturing firms coming in because announcements with regard to, you know, vastly larger storage capacity or improved vector processing. And it was great bringing the vector processing guys, we bring in the storage guys, and we get down into the speeds and feeds and the bits and bytes and go through all of this stuff. Great technical detail. And then, what are you guys doing? It was like, oh, let me show you. And they, this is all under NDA, right? Sure. You cover all the boards on the wall, all the flip charts around there, documents galore about what kind of things they were trying to do. And it was real brainstorm. And then you'd have the major Wall Street companies come in, brokerages, they come in and say, well, so tell us about using extremely large storage, using advanced vector processing. And we go through the bits and the bytes and the speeds and the feeds. And they'd say, so what are you guys working on? And they'd say, thank you for your time. Hey, it was like, this was before the word quant became a part of the lingo in the financial circles, but they were working obviously on very, very, you know, high speed trading algorithms where a millisecond meant millions of dollars in profitability, and they didn't want anybody to get into what it was they were about.
Yeah.
So for some firms, the channel actually becomes not just the source of technology and possibly technical assistance, becomes the chief technology officer. We've seen the following trends among dental and medical offices. You might want to consider this and this. Oh, really? Interesting dynamics in that space.
Yeah. And again, I just wanted to talk about it because it's a part of the IT security ecosystem that is an interesting part of the economics of it, as is the whole vulnerability landscape. That's a whole market and economics unto itself. Yeah. I just wanted to bring that up and give that kind of 2-second Wikipedia level answer.
Cool.
Just for folks who haven't been in that area. But if anybody works in the product space, intimately familiar with it, much more detail than this. In fact, it's a whole sub-discipline within product companies is dealing with that. Actually, sub-specialties within channel management, keeping them happy and keeping your partners happy. So, yeah.
Yep. Very good. Very good. So the other thing I know that we were talking about considering was this whole set of applications and tools and techniques for surveillance.
Yeah, just that right now, as we see so many people wearing masks out during the protests that have been happening this week, it is juxtaposition with all the facial recognition surveillance technologies that have gone on. And people were wearing masks to some protests before, for example, to protect themselves from being identified. And But now it's almost a reverse onus, is that so many masked people out on the street. It's a challenge to a lot of the state level surveillance, which is embodied in a person, but online is just somewhat invisible.
So. Right. I've seen some bits about various apps now, including capabilities to blur out faces. So if you're involved in a protest, you can avoid accidentally outing your fellow protesters.
Right.
And I think, you know, all in all, I think that's a good thing. My bias, and I'd love to hear from people different opinions on this, is that governments exist to serve the will of the people, not to lead, subvert the will of the people. So I think the biggest issue with governments tends to be overreach, trailed closely by incompetence. Sometimes it seems like a flat-out foot race. But surveillance mechanisms, and I think we touched on this in an earlier episode, you know, so often can be used for nefarious and inappropriate purposes that being able to put constraints on them, generally, I see as a good thing. I mean, I personally have never done any wrong, and I'm sure...
I have digital proof to the contrary.
And I'm sure none of you listening, you know, but if we close our eyes real tight and imagine really hard, we can probably think of somebody who may have done something that they wish weren't on the internet at this point in time, at least without their being quite so easily and readily identified.
I'm sure the authorities believe that sourdough starter is a code word that you and I are using to communicate with each other. Some top secret project we're working on.
That's right. Don't forget.
What's the status of the sourdough starter?
Thursday, 10 p.m. and bring the unbleached flour.
We've definitely passed one of the, you know, we look at the capability maturity models or Maslow's hierarchy. We've definitely gone into a new state of privacy now where privacy responsibility is much more in the hands of the individual. And by that, I mean, your example was, you know, previous generation was, hey, you know, protect ourselves. We're going to bring cameras to demonstrations. We're going to do that. And now, as you mentioned, that can be used as a public source now that it's all delivered online and collected together to get some very sensitive information. So it really is in the hand of the individuals now, as you said, do things like blurring them out, removing metadata, choosing what to put online, the raw versions or not. The next is, I think, an evolution of privacy technology to do that in bulk form. That's, I think, a ways off, but definitely for the individual now to protect people's identities where appropriate, whether it be for during demonstrations for social reasons or even corporate reasons. You know, there's all this webcasting and that going on inside companies. And there's always people with a sticky note on the wall of the password and all of that.
So. Yeah. Oh, shoot. Got to get that off there. Oh, we're not.
No, we're audio only today. So,
right.
How come unbleached flour is your password? What's with that? What's the hydration level?
70%, but the O, the zero is an O.
Yeah, it's an O, got an umlaut on it.
Right. And so it was 29 years ago when Rodney King was attacked in Los Angeles. It seems more recent than that. And one of the comments on that was, Big Brother is you watching. The amount of surveillance was new to traditional media.
Right.
And social media had just barely begun. I think MySpace was probably big. YouTube was probably, what, at that point, 10, 15 years in the future. We're growing into a new set of media. Marshall McLuhan talked about how different media cause people to view their world differently, and therefore our thinking processes are different. And certainly the intensity, the flood of information over social media is something. Being able to use high-speed algorithms to sort and classify individuals, and especially augment it with AI capabilities, so you'd say, based on this individual's demeanor, you know, he or she is likely to throw the first stone. That's beginning to tread into some awfully problematic territory. We hope we don't have to experience, but from an information security perspective, anonymization is a continuing problem. There's so much metadata, the way my voice sounds, the way my eyebrows look, the time of day of the picture, the shadows behind me, location data can be derived. Being truly anonymous is quite a challenge. So not only does everybody know you're a dog, but they know what you had for breakfast and when you need to be walked.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's very different too, geographically. Like certainly there's a much different attitude and acceptance and appetite for privacy and surveillance in, for example, Europe versus North America. And even within North America, it's greatly different. In Canada, privacy regulations in Quebec are much more robust than they are elsewhere, as are attitudes. You know, certainly in the United States, the state view versus other countries, it's just radically different. Even, of course, I mean, most European countries, and in some areas, there's just no concept of it at all. There's some countries that shall remain nameless, which is, you know, the state is so all powerful.
Right.
You know, even down to your web searches and the like. For those of us who traveled a lot and gotten that banner that popped up, by the way, everything you search on the web, we're going to be watching.
Right. So, well,
a strange experience.
I recall in the 90s being told that if I traveled to certain countries, that it would be best if I not bring my work PC at all. Get a loaner, use it for the duration of the trip, be circumspect in what I did, and then just wipe it when I got back.
Yeah, and we're to the stage now where there's some large tech companies who, when they travel, they have disposable laptops, and I mean, they're destroyed when they come back because they just can't trust them. So,
yeah.
That's not apocryphal. That's false sort of myth or something that's been a practice. I think it's less happening a little less often now, but it's still happening for certain companies.
Well, it does make sense. Take a look at some of the malware, the tricky stuff, the stuff that no garden variety cyber crook is going to go after, but what your nation state is likely to be able to fund. If you're in a business, if you're engaged in activity that would be particular interest to nation state actors, well, then you've got to assume that kind of surveillance capability could be aimed at you.
In the arc of things, we were at a period where it looked like there was going to be a high standard of privacy on the net, and that got reversed. Certainly the tide has shifted, so I don't think the tide will shift back, but I think where the privacy is going to be in the hands of end users, I think it's going to be incumbent on all of us to caveat emptor ourselves with privacy, and it's going to be in our hands. So can't be looking to outside parties or large social media companies to do it for us.
One of the elements of the Internet Safety for Kids and Families program that I've presented a few times at schools there, this is a thing that we try to do. It's not for fee, and the materials are not copyrighted. We'll just go to elementary, middle, and high schools and talk about Internet safety. But one of the rules is, don't be too generous with providing information. You get into a multiplayer game, and in some games, the default is that your information is publicly available. Anybody playing the game can see who you are and where you are, and you know, link to all sorts of other stuff. And we suggest people not do that. I mean, we are pretty good at some of that. Most parents know not to tag their kids in videos and then distribute them publicly. You know, for the same reason, you don't put your child's name on the outside of their backpack.
Right. Right.
Common sense.
It's a really tough time for I think you mentioned youth, and I think it's very tough because so much of their life is online and they're so connected. I hope and I believe today they're much more savvy. I know certainly there's a lot of youth who won't use Facebook today. I parse my communications between different apps. So there's things I'll see on Facebook Messenger, parties I'll deal with. So you can find all about our sourdough recipes on there. But for work conversations, limit them to their work apps, or if it's with colleagues in other companies, I'll use Signal or other more limited apps. It's funny though, when I had, one relative refuses to use Facebook Messenger, but they'll use WhatsApp because it's more secure.
Keep right. Bonehead.
You know, owns that.
Yeah.
Well, security through dumbness. Not even security theater at that point.
Yeah. They'll never look for me there.
Yeah.
I know that. There actually was a series of academic papers published recently talking about enhancing facial recognition to be able to derive identities from that subset of a person's face that you could see with a mask covering the lower half. Again, that's academically sound, but troubling nonetheless. On the other hand, if somebody is going to do something bad wearing a mask, we'll be able to track them down. Pro-crime in any sense. I'm just very much more concerned about, you know, civil liberties. That's that balance we were talking about before. You know, do you go for false positives or false negatives? Do you want to put innocent people in jail, or do you want to let guilty folks go free? You're not going to have a perfect system, so you have to bias it one way or the other, or else it looks capricious and random, and folks are going to say, well, if our governance mechanisms are capricious and random, then Let's find something different. Use that.
Right, instead. Right. Yeah, and I believe like our discussion on voting, I believe, for example, like COVID tracking, or your contact tracking apps are easily securable, easily. They could have fantastic privacy. If only it's a decision made. Inherently, do they have privacy? No. It's a very easy thing to do. Starts at the top down with legislation, regulations, and then down to the actual implementation. Exceptionally easy to have high amounts of privacy. But the default is no, not private. Going to keep data around forever. It's a very simple thing to do, but for some reason we choose to continuously avoid it.
Yeah, and that to me is just frankly baffling. It does no one any good to have gobs of data lying around. It's an invitation to fishing expeditions. It's an invitation to bad actors being able to synthesize or derive stories concerning individuals. If the data weren't there, then it couldn't be abused. If it were collected for a purpose and the purpose has been fulfilled, then it's no longer needed and it should be discarded. That's one of the nice things about GDPR, frankly, and Canadian PIPEDA, which is from the same point.
I have a biometric indicator on my desk, which is the unique imprint of my forehead that you can derive. You know, every time I hear this contact tracing thing, you know, thrown away as saying, oh, you know, the technology, if only the technology was there. Dude, it is ridiculously simple to have privacy in something like that contact tracing and to protect the state from itself, just to put in a rule and said, hey, it can only be used for the purpose which was collected. It is immune from search warrants and the like. Say, right. Hey, we know that there was a car stolen in this area that night. We want to find out if that was the person. We're going to put in a warrant for that. Make it immune from that. Simple. Then people would sign up more and you protect, you make it, you give the assurance, but if you're not giving any sort of warranty with it, forget it.
Yeah.
I'm not getting in that car. I'm not getting on that plane.
Yeah. It's tough. Well, this gets into the whole question of identity and access management. I mean, there are legitimate reasons why a person would want to use an application and not be identified as being user of that application. So how do you do that? You want to make rock solid sure that I'm the one who's accessing my bank account. I would like the information I gather to remain confidential. Now, if somebody has a legitimate reason to subpoena the bank, that's, they can go ahead and do that. But to intercept the transaction, I mean, that's getting into hackerish kind of stuff.
Oh, and I want to give a galactic wedgie to these people who say, like, I've got nothing to hide. That's not the point.
Right.
The point is that, you know, you should not have your whole life exposed at all times. If you're, you know, if you're a law-abiding citizen, it's the opposite.
It's a lousy default.
Yeah. And again, it's like this I have nothing to hide business is ridiculous. That is just, that's the stuff of non-democratic conversation. So.
Right. And what we've learned is that many of the people who loudly proclaim they have nothing to hide, turns out they have something to hide.
Hey, and it's just nobody's business. Like what I had for lunch yesterday is nobody's business. Is it a big secret? No. Will I pay money to hide it? No. But is it anybody's business? Absolutely not.
Right.
Mind your own beeswax.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Speaking of which, they've started relaxing rules. It is possible to go to restaurants, curbside pickup, takeout. We can go around and about. And I understand that our governor here in Connecticut has allowed people to start getting haircuts again. I am, however, standing firm. It'll be a little while before they trim my flowing locks.
Yeah, this is interesting. In fact, the same rule was passed today here in our jurisdiction. And my wife being a hairstylist, it's very close to home. It is seems dystopian, disproportionate, unusual that we can go from not even having been within 6 feet of my wife's parents to suddenly going to have us be in the face of a stranger. And so especially after there's been a lot of contacts lately through the demonstrations and things and summer and people are letting things slide. Yeah, that's a personal choice. You're going to protect yourself, much like a lot of the, you know, this personalization of privacy. I think, yeah, you have to look out for yourself and cybersecurity and these kinds of decisions. So yeah, that's, it's not a popular move in this household right now. So we're in a cautious sense, obviously.
I sympathize with you. I will be getting a haircut as soon as the majority of the epidemiologists I know have gotten their haircuts.
Ah, great. Yeah, there's a good numbers socialized around today on did you see that article on
yes.
took a poll of what epidemiologists were doing?
Right.
When will you go for a haircut? When will you go to a restaurant? And I thought that was very enlightening.
Right. Exactly. And they have no reason to lie about that. You know, they're not being paid unless maybe they got their stimulus checks from the Soros.
Everyone's an epidemiologist suddenly, but they stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
That's right. Yeah, amazing how rapidly we develop a new crop of constitutional scholars overnight.
But we're all in the business of risk. So I actually give a pass to a lot of people who have opinions because, hey, we have to make these risk decisions ourselves, whether it be in cybersecurity or elsewise, to say, hey, will I participate in this or not? Or what's my personal risk? And of course, it's going to vary. It should vary by vertical, your own personal status, your personal medical risk. So it should vary, but we need to help people make risk decisions. So I like the regional data that they put out in the COVID sense. That's very, very helpful to make local decisions better. And the same with cybersecurity for certain activities. We've got tons of data out there now to help make these decisions. Certainly for the privacy arena, we need more of it.
Yeah. Although I will say that with regard to security, it generally remains a good practice to keep your apps relatively current. I'm not saying slap the next update on as soon as it arrives, especially where apps are used that have potential security privacy vulnerabilities in them. The updates and fixes that are being distributed against those will tend to improve their posture regarding your privacy and security of your information and your actions. Just a reminder, this is for the general user. You know, take the time, update those apps, run a virus scan, take a look at what's going on. Don't share things you don't need to and be pretty much all right.
Really highlights the cloud view of the world, which is so simple, where everything's updated all the time. Whereas, the on-prem stuff, a lot of the uninformed will say, well, you just keep it up to date all the time. Why don't you do that? Well, you have never worked in IT, my friend.
Yeah. I remember reading recently, and maybe you could correct me if I misinterpreted this, but if you take a look at all of the currently available software products for all verticals, and of course nobody would have a tenth of this, that the number of updates in a typical month for all software products exceeds 5,000 or 6,000.
Now, makes sense.
Yeah, you may only be using a tenth or a hundredth of all available software products. But if you're using 100th, that means you've got 50 updates a month. That means you've got two every workday. It means you're going to have somebody, probably a team, taking a look at updates as they come in twice a day, doing the appropriate QA, doing the appropriate regression test, and then rolling the thing into production. I mean, my goodness, that is a full-bore, hardcore development organization. And sad to say, they're not improving the company's bottom line. They're not improving service to customers outside of indirectly providing a more safe, secure, trustworthy platform. But how do you put that in your marketing literature? Buy from us because we update our software more rapidly than the other guy, as far as we can tell.
Yeah, the flip side of the cloud model, where it seems so easy to keep things up to date, there's actually a reverse to that, is for other things other than apps that you use. So for example, libraries, open source libraries, all that stuff that goes into the apps you make, not just use, that those are a major source of concern. Companies, that's their whole product line now, is just making sure that these are secure. So for dev shops, it's twice as hard because you can't just, of course, then the real timeness of this, of how you will update that. Of course, when you have this great web of your containers, your libraries, app components, the databases, the database add-ons, all the APIs you're using, that is a complex web. And now all that is in scope. So It's one thing to say, hey, all my apps are updated. Yeah, the ones commercial ones you use, great, high five, but now's the hard work. Those 300 apps that your company uses that are internal, what about those? And the 25 to 50 bits of those that need to be patched, updated, monitored, and especially when it's all real time now, or just in time, or constantly changing. The app was fine an hour ago, but that's not the app that's currently running in the image itself.
Right. It's the supply chain problem being taken up to a higher level. It's not just the materials, but it's the process by which those materials are assembled. That's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, and the infrastructure components themselves. So it's one thing to say, yeah, my switches are up to date, but the infrastructure components within that, your container management, all this stuff, and even your security management stuff. Now, security never used to be the subject of vulnerabilities. It was always the big golden rule, like there shall never be, good old days, there shall never be vulnerabilities in security products. Those were the good times.
Yes.
But yeah, now, the infrastructure itself has to be robust.
Yeah, and it's getting tougher. I remember when I was young, I used to do work on my own car. It was easy. And those wonderful craftsman tools, and I knew what to do, and I could get a good oil filter at any one of three or four different vendors. And now, cars are higher end, significant amount of computerization, things that I can't tune. I mean, even if I had a timing light, I still wouldn't know what commands to enter to adjust the performance of the engine from a computer controlled, call it industrial IoT with a small I,
right,
in there. So what do? Do I abandon it? Heck no. I find a trusted vendor that I go to. These days, there's a dealership that offers the car, and I trust them to do the right things. I've been watching these wonderful car shows where somebody will come in and say, I'd like you to rebuild my 65 and a half Mustang, and I have an unlimited budget. So they say, yeah, well, this is an everyday experience for me. I've got $250,000 to drop on a 45-year-old car. And then they'll go to town on it. They'll, you know, replace the frame, they do all this stuff. And then at one point, you know, they'll take the motor out and they'll take it around the corner to the best motor shop in Salt Lake City or Dallas or Houston or whichever one it is that I'm looking at. And it comes back and it's perfectly timed. And it's a wonderful fantasy,
yes,
utopian existence where,
yeah,
every part is correct. Every technician is fair and honest and true. Every subcontractor is noble and loyal and selfless. And they'll work the extra time, make that thing work, and then the fellow takes his keys, says, "Wow, it looks great," and drives off into the sunset. It's kind of like watching a Western from the
1950s. All is well. He rides off into the sunset. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, with my case, it was usually I'd call my buddy and say, "Well, I want to change the plugs on the Fliver," and he'd say, "Well, great. How do you think it'd take? 15 or 20 minutes. He says, "Great. I'll clean out the guest room and lay out the sleeping bag."
Yeah.
We'd get halfway through it, crack a plug, find they were out of stock at this store. And it was a social occasion.
Yeah, it's so frustrating too when things are software definable that they're not there. So I have a case where my winter tires don't have the pressure sensor in them because it cost me, you know, many hundreds of dollars. They just can't justify. But I get a warning light saying, "Hey, yo, problem with the tires." And there's no way to fix it. The company does not give a thing to say, "Oh, there's no sensors there. That's the issue." Instead, they say, "Oh my God, there's something catastrophic going on with your tires."
Right.
And even the dealership cannot disable that. This is not an option. It's software definable. They can push me updates. Mm. And they just choose not to do it. They're rotten so-and-so. Mm. I want me a Tesla.
Is it a light, or is it a light accompanied by a buzzer?
There's no buzzer, but it's an amber warning with text that just stays on the main panel no matter what.
Yep. Yeah.
All winter long. So it reminds me how much it's like a constant poke in the chest saying, "We're an old fashioned auto company."
Yeah.
Jerks.
Yeah. You know. You should have spent a couple $100 more on the tires and bought them from us. Then you wouldn't have to see this annoying warning.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Some trivial software thing they could do to say, even in the settings, I can't change it. Well, as I mentioned, the dealership can't do it. So I certainly couldn't, but
yeah,
I can't disable that. So thanks a lot, guys.
A piece of black electrical tape over there.
I just cover my eyes while I drive. That's funny too, because the car has very intelligent road assisted driving. It's effectively almost autopilot-y, but yep, can't get rid of that thing. Mm. Yeah. Put my life in their hands to drive me down the road without my hands on the wheel, should I choose, but nope, can't do that. I want me a Tesla.
Well, good luck with that. We can sort of go find
it. I've been fascinated lately by dreaming about some of these alternative automobiles too. Like, I've been looking at you ever seen a Chamberlain?
No.
Not a Chamberlain. No, sorry. Yeah, Vanderhall.
No.
It's a three-wheeled little sports car, single wheel in the back, two up front, mm-hmm. and it looks like an old-fashioned racing car.
Hmm. What, with the wheels outside of the frame?
Yeah. It's like a Buck Rogers version of an old-fashioned racing car. There's a lot of the slingshots around here because they're designed by Bombardier, but this is Vanderhalls are pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's a car, but it's a cycle.
Yeah. You need a motorcycle license to drive it, of course, which I have, but what a cool vehicle. That's the latest fantasy vehicle.
Mm, I'm waiting for my flying car. I'm on the 16th floor, so I just park it on the balcony.
There's a band called We Were Promised Jetpacks, I think it was.
Yes.
Great name. Yeah. I'm not usually a car guy, but of course, nowadays you kind of have to be. Although, when's the last time you filled up the tank on your vehicle?
March. I'm one of the OCD few. I have a book in the glove box where I list every transaction involving my car, you know, the date, the time, the mileage, and what was done. You know, inflated the tires, put in gas, changed the oil filter, all of that
stuff. Why doesn't your car manufacturer give you an app to do that?
Well, they probably do if I were to buy a car that were made in the current decade.
Doesn't matter.
Well, yeah. You see, my
brand loyalty, they should be pushing that on you. Get you, like, even the car that's not modern, get you into the modern world with it. They should be helping you stay loyal.
They should. I wish they would. I'm the kind of a person who will buy a car and I buy it. I don't lease it. And I will drive it to the moon. And I mean that literally.
Yep.
I've driven four cars past 240,000 miles before they gave up the ghost or some tragic accident took them from me. So I am not the kind of a demographic that the car manufacturers look for. I'll probably buy two more cars in my life. So they're looking at me and saying, let's not waste a lot of marketing dollars on this schlub.
I downloaded the app that my automaker provided, and I was all excited because it was a, you know, advanced vehicle, and boring, nothing in there to help me. I can schedule appointments with their thought with the dealership and that. Oh, I thought that's kind of useful. That doesn't work. I go to their website. Pointless app. Thank you.
Yeah, that's it's a platform. When I was early days in IT, we learned that vendors would construct what was the hierarchy? A foundation for a framework, for a platform, for an architecture, for a vision.
Ah.
I think that was the hierarchy.
Could you say that again? That was cool.
A foundation for a framework, for a platform, for an architecture, for a vision.
Ah, cool.
That's the ground up hierarchy of marketing needs. You know, God bless them. They want to sell stuff. That's fine. I'd love to be able to buy stuff, but I'm just not the guy who's going to buy a barrel of apples, eat two, and then throw the rest out and buy another barrel of apples. That just ain't the way I roll.
Right, right. Have you seen the Netflix show Upload yet? Seen the ads for it?
Not.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a little take on modern technology, and there's some, you know, security stuff in there, of course, but it's a recommended viewing for anybody if you're looking for some fun, light viewing in these times. Upload. It's about after you die. Just before you die, you can get yourself uploaded.
And so instead of Cairo freezing?
Right, but it freezes the heads.
Right, now it's cyber freezing.
Right, right. From a privacy issue, we're talking about it as well. It's interesting. Sadly, as time goes on, you have more of your people you know pass on. It's always creepy with their online presence staying there. Of course, more often now, there's mechanisms to help with that. But also, loved ones or something, communicating through those mediums is getting a little better. But
yeah,
it's remarkable how many stale snapshot in times there are of the people who passed on and their social media and other online presence.
I think Gogol wrote an entire novel about that. We had an incident on Facebook. A beloved math teacher who was also a tennis coach when I was in high school, which was in the late 60s. He passed on last fall. They named a park after him in the town. I got a friend request from him. It's like, I think this account's been hacked.
Oh, you unbeliever, you. It could be a message from beyond. Come on.
A message from beyond? Yeah, I think so. Time zone would suggest it was probably the other side of the world. So,
yeah.
Around.
I have noticed personally a reduction in the amount of callers, the scam calls in these uncertain times. Seems like that's affected that business. So.
What's your secret? I seem to get about three.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought the call centers had kind of closed down.
Oh, well, that would be delightful. Well, these must be fully automated because I get the same call. We're calling you because we haven't heard about your extended car warranty.
Yeah.
I have to beg my dealership to take my car in for an oil change. So I'm pretty sure there's no legitimate extended warranty possible on that clunker. But I love it. I love it. But not
my my favorite ones are now, of course, the people saying are equivalent of the social security numbers, you know, going to expire or be revoked because of bad things I've done. So, that would be a service I'd pay for.
That's right.
My old contacts have our social security number. That was our identifier in the military. It was the same as then later on they issued service numbers that were different. They wised up, but back then that was your number.
Oh, yeah. When I got my driver's license in Massachusetts, my social security number was my driver's license number.
Right, right. Yeah. And over time, we always wanted to say, well, why should I be concerned about that? And over time, oh, yeah, it's something I can't, I probably don't want to have to change.
Right. And I'll tell you something. I can remember as a kid, there was no such thing as skyjacking. The word didn't exist. You wanted to fly. You bought a ticket. You walked on the plane. Your sister and your mom come along and they give you a hug and they see you sit down in the seat and then they walk off the plane.
Right, right. Yeah, you can just walk right up to the gate.
Right. I mean, it's like train travel today.
Yep.
You get on the train, you can walk off the train. Nobody's going to scan anything. It's just a different medium. And it's fascinating. This is where the whole, Bruce Schneier, security theater.
Right.
Absurd, ridiculous. You know, we all take our shoes off. For what? Why? Okay. Once upon a time, there was this fellow.
Yep. Israelis had that figured out. In fact, there's a lot of things we're learning nowadays about groups and contacts and tracing and privacy. These all come together again with this airline example that we're all too often having to reference, unfortunately. Yeah.
I was on a flight back from Israel some years ago, and there was a fellow who was complaining about the rigor of the search. And I was standing away from him, and he started, I wouldn't do any. Why don't you just put my bags on the plane and let's get going? Because you had to be there like 2.5 hours early and they hand searched the luggage. And I leaned over to the security individual, a charming young woman carrying an Uzi. And I said, you have my permission to shoot him. And she just kind of smiled like, it's Thursday.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, once again, there's the counter, of course, is that having information about individuals, you can make really informed decisions about their threat level. On the other hand, do you want the state having that kind of information? So real, that's, of course, the classic conflict writ large.
Well, yeah, right. And then we get into the minority report scenario.
Right, right. Or the good, smart, bad guys will obey the measures. Only dumb, bad guys will not, or the innocent will, you know, be right. Caught up in them. So
that's one of the subtexts they don't go into when they talk about the fact that crooks are dumb because they get caught. Well, the dumb ones get caught. Maybe the really smart ones don't get caught. And
that's why the backdoor argument, I think, is so weak, that building backdoors, you know, for law enforcement. Yeah, there's, you know, and if you do have to comply with law enforcement, but putting backdoors that can be compromised by bad guys too is a really bad thing. And bad guys, good bad guys, know what tools and techniques they can use and can't use. And we'll avoid contact. As we've seen through wars in the last while, just trying to, when you had these individuals who were undetectable, uncatchable, and they're dodging and weaving, you can make their life difficult, of course, but.
Clipper chip.
Ah, the clipper chip. There you go. That was the beginning of the end of privacy, was the clipper chip.
There was an article in the New York Times from June 1994, but it was April of 93 when the White House announced the clipper chip was going to be used to secure communications. And that even gets back to the older story about DES, right? When IBM was working on DES, digital encryption standard for high secure transactions, the specification IBM came with was 64-bit DES. The federal government mumbled something and said 56 bits is plenty. And you know, apparently, great minds in cryptography in the U.S. federal government decided that 56-bit DES was essentially uncrackable. And the question was, is the, you know, NSA's perspective is that it is uncrackable, or rather that it is uncrackable by everybody else?
Right, right. We want people to only use 4-pin master lock, master padlocks.
That's right.
Their secrets. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and we had that wonderful conversation about lockpicking and all that stuff. I still want to thank you for that. That was spectacular. That was just spectacular. So you have it on tape, folks. I actually know how to pick a very simple lock.
And you're good at it, too.
Well.
You're fast. Very fast.
I got good on the lock we got. I've been trying it around here. Some of the locks in this apartment building are a little hard. That's called That's a joke, people.
I'm wondering about all those new bicycles that you had.
That's right. Citibank got nothing on me.
Well, Bill, shall we call it here today? We've covered a lot of ground. We've talked about the channel. We've talked rangingly about privacy, automobiles. You've covered some good ground today, as always.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So, but for now, signing off. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you for the rich conversation. I always come away from this more positive and more enriched than I went in. So thank you. That brings us to the end of this edition of Real Cybersecurity. I'm Greg Young.
And I'm Bill Malik.
Thanks for your time and attention today and joining us on our journey. Remember to follow us on Twitter at Real Cybersecurity, and our email address is podcast@realcybersecurity.net. Thanks.